Thank you for having me here today. I'm very pleased and thrilled to be a guest of the Friends of the Library. I've spent a lot of my life in libraries, so I'm very gratified to see how much a part of the community this library is. And when I arrived, I said to Mr. Wilkins, I asked Mr. Wilkins if there were anyone here today who I should eat. So either I am overexcited or I have so thoroughly imbibed the spirit of Daisy Bates that I've become a cannibal. So, all right. I hope afterwards that you will have questions, because that is my favorite part. I began my life as a writer through reading, and I suspect that most writers did too. I was an early reader. I see from my awkward signature in a moldy copy of Robinson Crusoe that I read it for the first time when I was 7 years old. I'm sure that I did not understand much of it. I lived in the country then, on the north shore of the island of Oahu, in a small village called Punalu, with my father, my brothers and sisters, and my adorable mother, who was losing her mind. As she became less and less rational, I grew convinced that I could see parts of bodies on the clean floor of the ocean. And for some time, and to everyone's bafflement, I would not go near the water. I spent my time instead with books, quickly exhausting the modest resources of the small provincial library, where I discovered, among other treasures, that erotic masterpiece about Charles II, Forever Amber. I'd been given permission by the amiable librarian, a Samoan woman intent on converting me to Mormonism, to borrow books from the adults' only shelves after bringing her a letter I'd extracted from my mother, in which my mother swore that the books were for her own use. That was the beginning. The days were very long, as summer days are for children in the countryside, and I found for myself a secret place where I could read under the trees in a grove of coconut palms, out of sight of the refuge of the sea. The trees were said to have been planted by King Kamehameha IV in 1850, and it was a cool and shaded place. There was the sound of the trade wind in the branches, and I could just make out the voices of my brothers and sisters over the constant rush and sweep of the ocean. I would sometimes spend the entire day in the grove, wrapping myself in a mat when I grew sleepy, dimly and uneasily aware that while I did not yet understand what it meant to be attached to this earth, I must not make the mistake of imagining that art or even beauty was something available to everyone. As I began to understand that imagination is a luxury, I slowly learned to shut out the world's turmoil in exchange for silence, in the hope, always, that the essence of things, the essence of something, would reveal at least a small part of its mystery. I grew up with people who believed unquestioningly in the spirits. This was of great benefit to me. Simply to walk through the groves where I lived as a child was to enter a magical realm of taboos, spells, and curses. On the small island of Molokai, a haunted place of cowboys and fishermen, a neighborhood storyteller, Harriet Ney, saw the spirits known as the Night Marchers as recently as 30 years ago. "It is in this season they call October and November," she would say, "that they come, walking, walking, and chanting as they walk." That night, the first man was of the chief's class, tall and strong. And as we watched, the marchers continued down the hill to the house and disappeared inside. I sat at Harriet Ney's feet as a girl and listened to her stories, all of them fanciful to the point of implausibility with magic and myth, stories that were literally incredible. And after each of Aunt Harriet's stories, one more chilling than the next, she would say, "I myself have seen it," and I believed her, succumbing perhaps not so innocently to what Coleridge called the suspension of disbelief. And years later, myself a storyteller, I used her injunction as title for one of my books. Which is not to say that I am as literal or as inspired as Aunt Harriet, or as truthful. With maturity, or shall I say, time, a certain shyness, a certain reticence has overtaken me. It is almost a feeling of shame. The revelation of infantile fears and wishes, even in the form of metaphor, is no longer so compelling to me. My earliest work seems excruciatingly puerile, even vainglorious in its revelation. I have come to accept, however, that when the public reads fiction, the public really likes to believe that what it is reading is true. I don't mean true in the sense that all fiction is true, but the literal truth. The reader wishes, more than wishes, the reader requires for his well-being that fiction represent the real. And all this despite V.S. Naipaul's warning that fiction never lies, it is autobiography that lies. In truth, the worst way to read a book is in the expectation, the assumption that the characters are real. The good reader understands that this need for real life, this instinct and craving for veracity, is not only impossible to gratify, but is beside the point. The reality of a character or a situation depends solely on the writer's ability to convincingly create a world of his own. And if he succeeds, no matter how preposterous or strange this world may be, we are convinced of its authenticity. Like other writers, I have had a most difficult time convincing readers that my books are not real, and despite my injunction that I myself have seen it. To quote Nabokov, "The girl Emma Bovary never existed. The book Emma Bovary shall exist forever and ever. A book lives longer than a girl." In the beginning of their writing careers, most writers are by necessity content, more than content, preoccupied and belabored with their own stories. Some writers never outgrow this. Ideally, at a certain point, usually after a writer's third or fourth book, and somewhat to his surprise, his own life catches up with him. There are no more stories to tell about himself. He has used all of his own material. And upon reaching this stage of experience, a writer is fortunate if lost anecdotes, forgotten stories, memories idly stored, rise mysteriously to the surface. Mysterious because you inevitably ask, why this particular story, and why now? 20 years ago, when I finished my third book about Hawaii, I realized, somewhat forlornly and certainly with a sense of panic, that I'd come to the end of my own particular tall tales. I'd reached, so to speak, my present self, and I began to cast about anxiously for a subject. In the end, it was a good thing. It compelled me to leave my childhood. It forced me into the world. It forced me to make up things, and it forced me to do research. To quote Henry James, "Possible stories, presentable figures rise from the thick jungle as the observer moves, fluttering up like startled game, and before he knows it, he has fairly to guard himself against the brush of importunate wings. In an author's note accompanying Nostromo, Joseph Conrad wrote that many years earlier in the Gulf of Mexico, he'd heard a wisp of a rumor about a man who was said to have stolen single-handed a boat full of silver. He heard no other details. 30 years later, while rummaging in a second-hand bookstore, he happened upon a shabby edition of a memoir written by an American seaman. In the book, the adventure itself only takes 3 pages. The sailor claims to have once stolen a boat heavily loaded with silver. "Nothing to speak of," writes Conrad, "but the curious confirmation of the few casual words heard in my early youth evoked the memories of that distant time, a time when everything was fresh, surprising, venturesome, interesting. There still was in the world something to write about. You have been thinking for years and years about something, and it never occurred to you that it was your story. It one day becomes clear. But of course it takes patience and skill and good fortune and time. I begin with a character. As you know, there are many kinds of characters. Henry James's peripheral but all the same essential character, who observes the story with the same mystification and curiosity as the reader, placing himself in the same position as the reader as he affects to be in the dark as to the motives of his fellow characters, which is most like life. The right to intermittent knowledge has a parallel to our actual experience of life. We know less at some times than at others. In Henry James, however, there is little recourse to what we might consider daily life. The characters often do not have to work. All they need to do, and I use the word all with irony, is conduct extremely subtle conversations which reveal the even more subtle shifts in power. When sufficient shifts have been achieved, James reveals the balance of power to be irrevocably and profoundly altered. There is Joan Didion's ironical and self-conscious character, sometimes even called Joan Didion herself, in which she tells you the plot in the very first paragraph of the book and then fills in the blanks. And there is Stendhal's historical figure, for example, a creature both of his own ambition and the strivings of history. My character is a solitary figure, often a woman. What will she do, I ask myself when I begin to write, not only at the start of a novel, but at the start of each working day? If I trust my character, she will tell me. Studying her with careful attention, while all the time giving her an inordinate freedom, she will reveal herself to me. How she looks and speaks and thinks, what she is wearing as she sleeps fitfully in the room that I have made for her. There is in her story a certain inevitability, which all the same often surprises and confounds me. The novelist must know everything about his character, but choose not to tell us all that he knows. Many of the facts may be, in truth, should be hidden. In our own lives, we cannot expect to understand one another fully, but in the novel, we attempt to rectify this mystery. The secret life of a character may or may not be visible, whereas in real life, secret lives are invisible. That is why novels comfort us. They suggest a clearer and thus more manageable race of human beings and give us the illusion of power and control. My book, In the Cut, arrived by way of Raymond Chandler and Sherlock Holmes. While I was writing the last Hawaiian novel, I read every mystery and thriller I could find. Books about detectives in Bombay and judges in Stockholm, as well as the American classics that came to form the core of the genre known as noir. I read certain books when I am writing because I do not want to be distracted and I do not want to be corrupted. If I were to read Faulkner, let us say, while I am writing, two things are bound to happen. I will begin to doubt my own work, quite understandably, and I will unconsciously and sometimes even consciously begin to parody a writer's style, even to insert some of his words and phrases and rhythms into my own work. I've learned over the years that it is best to read something utterly disparate from the book at hand, memoirs of the French Revolution, say, or books about amphibians. To my surprise, then, I realized when I finished what I knew would be, by necessity, my last Hawaiian novel, that I wanted to write my own detective story. What is more, I wanted to play with the form. I wanted to take the traditional American crime story and turn it upside down. I wanted my crime fighter, my dissolute, tired, cynical detective, who is typical of the genre, to be a woman. And I wanted my female detective to survive at the end of the book. As it turned out, the detective in the cut is not a woman, and the heroine does not survive. But I did not know that then. I knew only that in order to write the book, I would have to do research, something I had never done before in writing fiction. My imagination is vivid, but I needed facts. I even needed impressions. While it is possible to do absolutely anything with the novel, it is one of its charms as well as one of its terrors. The one thing that I did not want was to propagandize either for a cause or a point of view. It was in my interest, it is always in the interest of a writer, to be without an opinion at all, a position that later was to cause me to disappoint some critics and readers. But the writer's work, I believe, is to render the world, not to alter it. My next book, One Last Look, came to me in the streets of Calcutta, where I lived for a year. The novel that I hoped to write about the Second World War first seemed possible one afternoon at tea with a displaced countess in Berlin. I came to Daisy Bates in much the same way that I found the 19th century blue stocking Emily Eden, who was to be the subject of my novel, One Last Look. 7 years ago, I spent the summer with Jane Campion in Sydney while we worked on a screenplay of In the Cut. I had fallen in love with Australia. Jane and I had become friends, and I was not eager to return to America. Jane noticed that I had been reading the diaries and journals of early adventurers and travelers in Australia, Rachel Henning and Watkin Tench, among others more obscure, such as George Fletcher Moore, books leading to more and more books, as you know. And she suggested that I write a screenplay about Daisy Bates that she would then make into a film. Naturally, I was very pleased with this idea. I came to Adelaide, where I spent many, many days in this library, with Perth as my final destination. I camped for 2 weeks on the Nullarbor Plain in the spot that seemed closest to Daisy Bates' own encampment near the railroad siding at Oldea and again at Eucla. For someone who is such a controversial and even important figure in the tempestuous history of Aboriginal studies, it was surprising to me that there was no marker to indicate her camp of many years, nor any recognition of her other than a small and dusty museum in the southern coastal town of Streaky Bay. That may have changed in the time since, as there does not seem to be a surfeit of interest in her. My research of Daisy Bates differed in several ways from the time that I spent with New York homicide detectives or the time that I have spent teaching in prison. When I was with the detectives, I took no notes and made no judgments, in part because I understood that the minute I did so, my time with them would be abruptly ended. When I was teaching in prison, I had already written my last novel, The Big Girls, although my work in the prison was enormously helpful in amending many of the mistakes I had made in the first draft of the novel. With Daisy Bates, the information is all there, an abundance of information, letters, short stories, field notes, newspaper articles, photographs, monographs. Paradoxically, it is all that is not there, or there only by inferences and hints, that interests me. Her tendency to mythomania, her snobbery, her shame of her Irish childhood, and later her vitriol against the Catholic Church. And although I think that bigamy was far more common both here and in America than is realized, it must have taken some nerve to conceal the illegality of her third marriage, some unshakable and steely confidence to maintain her anachronistic values, her Edwardian patriotism, her fervid imperialism, her hatred of Germany, her defense of the heartless treatment of the Aborigines of Western Australia by the pastoralists. Her attitude toward half-castes is shocking to us now. She did not hesitate to say that with few exceptions, and this is a quote of hers, the only good half-caste is a dead half-caste, justifying her views with a combination of sentimentality and mendacity. It sometimes occurs to me that her delusions, her vulnerable existence, both in the real world and in the world of fantasy, her penury and her lack of recognition of her ethnographic work, may have led her to create her own kingdom on the edge of the desert, where she could reign unquestioned and all-powerful as a magical reincarnation, a spirit revered and feared by the Aboriginals arriving from the northern deserts, the great white queen of the Never Neverlands. What is not literally there in the research is that she was, as far as I can discern, a rather unlikable person, despite the questionable good that she did for the natives of Australia, particularly those of the West and South, and despite ethnographic field work that is now considered valuable by some, no matter how disputed it has always been by other scientists and scholars. Quite understandably, despite the sloppiness of some of her field work and her loose claims of cannibalism, it is easy to question the truthfulness of her studies, given that she lied so easily about her own origins. But it is just this nastiness, this lack of honesty, this vicious practicality that interests me as a novelist. How driven, resourceful, disciplined, even desperate she must have been. A terrible mother to her own abandoned son, but a kind and unselfish mother to the natives who depended on her for their very existence. Known to be flirtatious and charming in her younger country house days, her last days were spent in profound solitude. In two of her letters from the 40s, when she was camped at Windbring Siding on the Nullarbor Plain, 80 years old, nearly blind with chronic trachoma after years of desert dust storms, more than a bit mad, and certainly embittered and discouraged, she wrote to a friend here in Adelaide, "My success, thank God, lies and has lain with my forbearance and readiness to serve them in trouble, and never ever worrying them. And time is short with us. More than 50 of these groups have passed on. But I have returned to my high place in their regard. And now, with their return to me and pride in being Kabbalese mob, I find my instincts were right, and that I took the quiet, gentle way with them and the never, ever fault-finding way with them. And in another letter of that period, she wrote, I long for a chat with my own kind, but I don't mention these 10 things to anyone. Who could not be stirred by her words? And what writer could not be interested? As a writer, it is most gratifying in the end that life prevails, interferes, placates, distracts, inspires. It would be unbearable if it refused to us the solace available to each of us, that is, the solace of memory. It is simply the writer who puts it on paper, and the basis of a novel is simply a story, and a story is a series of events arranged in time. A memoir, however, is history based on evidence, whereas a novel is based on evidence plus or minus X. Historians deal with the characters of individuals only insofar as they can deduce attributes from their actions. The historian may be as much concerned with character as the novelist, but he can only know, actually know, what exists on the surface. What is fictitious, then, in the novel is not the story, but the way in which thought becomes action. Character becomes plot, not something particularly knowable in everyday life. The belief, the desire that a book be based solely on a writer's or character's experience is almost an insult, implying a paucity, if not failure, of imagination on the part of the writer. In my novel, In the Cut, the erotic passages gave to this misperception an added thrill. I can only say, as I have said many times before, that my books are novels. Even, I must admit, the memoir of my childhood in Hawaii. Despite a writer's efforts as disguise, his subject will and must remain himself. Proust said that in fashioning a work of art, we are by no means free. We do not choose how we shall make it. It pre-exists, and therefore we are obliged, since it is both necessary and hidden, to do what we should have to do if it were a law of nature, that is to say, to discover it. So in the end, as with Emily Eden and now Daisy Bates, it is all that is not there that excites me. All that is not explained or recorded or even surmised. It is the unspoken, even the unimagined, that awakens my interest. In One Last Look, I shaped a sister's fervent affection for her brother into incest. Like bigamy, I suspect that it was more common than we know. Much to the irritation of some Eden scholars. I do not yet know what I will make of Daisy Bates, but I have my suspicions. Nietzsche defined truth as a mobile army of metaphors, which is a very good description of a book, fiction or otherwise. In the Christian era, we have staked a great deal on the belief that to know the truth is the unstinting purpose of our lives. Freud has taught us that the truth will set us free. One way of seeking the truth is through literature. I am quite sure that I could never have learned for myself all that Proust and Homer, Eliot and Lady Murasaki, and now even Daisy Bates, have learned for me. those idiosyncratic, even contradictory, highly individualistic truths which nevertheless become one single important truth. The novelist Eudora Welty once said of her mother that she read Dickens as if she were going to elope with her. And I know that feeling. I have spent most of my life in love with the lawyer Gavin Stevens in William Faulkner's novel Knight's Gambit, and I am deeply attracted to Trollope's Irish gentleman Phineas Finn. But that is about fantasy, not reality. Imagination is the source of desire just as it is the source of metaphor, and we cannot write or read without it. I shall now read to you for a few minutes some of my fictions. I want to read a few pages of, not even a few pages, a few lines from a memoir, so ostensibly nonfiction, and then a scene from a novel in which I have turned it into fiction, hoping to show you in a more specific way what it is that a writer does with research. I can't do it yet from Daisy Bates because I'm not yet finished a first draft and I'm unsure of what I've written. So I'm going back to two books of my own. But you'll see in a minute what I'm doing. So I will read first. This is just a little paragraph from a memoir about growing up. When I was writing this paper, I thought, oh, it will be so interesting. I will have the audience try to guess which is which. And, of course, when I was doing it, there's absolutely no question which is which. So obvious. In my mind's eye, they were much closer. All right, so this is the nonfiction. This is the research, so to speak. I was not given much spending money. I remember saving to buy a small brown paper sack of raisins, and indeed, I did not need money. My mother was not only generous when necessary, but could effortlessly enter the imagination of a child. When I was 10, I determined the need for a professional portrait and took myself to the studio of a Japanese photographer that I'd often passed on my bus ride home. He did not speak English. His business was mail-order bride portraits, I soon realized. But he did not question my somewhat odd request, which I demonstrated with hand signs and a few words of pidgin English. Nor did my mother question it when I asked her for the exorbitant sum of money he demanded for rather too many girlish poses, 18, nine of them with my chin resting lightly in my palm. Okay, so that's the, so to speak, fact. And then here's what happens to research. Perhaps it was this feeling of tentativeness and isolation that led her one hot afternoon into town and into the dusty photography studio of Mr. Yasunobu Sugiyama. Mr. Sugiyama's modest business was to take photographs of Japanese wedding parties and small family groups, photographs to be ceremoniously sent back to Japan to provincial parents and grandparents. The solemn faces in the portraits could be framed at the sitter's choice in hand-tinted pink cherry blossoms or red temple gates. The photographs were used, too, as burial cards. Mimi had looked at them closely whenever she was in the Buddhist cemetery, pasted onto the grave markers, and prettily decorated with silk flowers and paper inscriptions when the grave was fresh. Perhaps that is where she first had the idea of being photographed. Mr. Sugiyama was certainly very surprised to see the Howley girl come into his little store that humid day. He did not speak English very well, only a few words, but she spoke to him in English as if he could understand her, and she did not raise her voice or speak very slowly in a way that would have patronized him. He ushered her through the faded calico curtain with elaborate politeness and sat her in a wooden folding chair and gave her a pink plastic comb and mirror. She smoothed down her hair and ruffled up her eyebrows with saliva, the way the maid had taught her to do. She was wearing a lei of pikake. He moved her head, tilted her chin this way and that, and straightened her collar. She allowed him to pose her as he liked, and then she froze obediently, holding the pose while he studied her. The poses were not very sophisticated, an index finger held to the chin, cocked head resting on a fist, but Mimi did not know any better. She was concerned that his deep frown meant disapproval, but when he finished fussing and backed away from her, smiling, pleased with his work, she saw that it was only concentration that made him look so serious. He disappeared under his black cloth. He took far more photographs of her than he would customarily have taken of the shy Japanese bride in her heavy wig and wedding kimono, who was his usual subject. This odd, solemn child was altogether something out of his experience. And if he spent more time with her than was usual, it was because she interested him. When they finished, they shook hands and bowed low several times. He watched her with curiosity as she went out into the harsh light, and when she reached the corner, she looked back and bowed again. And then, a few pages later, she went back several times to Mr. Sugiyama's photography studio to look at the proofs and to select the poses she liked best. Mr. Sugiyama had his own particular favorites, and they spent quite a bit of time over their final choices. At one point, Mr. Sugiyama went into the back and made green tea for them. In the end, although she preferred a rather perky shot that was not at all like her, at least in spirit, she succumbed and agreed with Mr. Sugiyama that the serious photograph of the girl, it was hard for her to think that the images were of herself, with the hopeful gaze was the best one. He was very pleased that she agreed with him. She ordered 5 prints. She returned only once more to pick up the finished photographs. She had never once considered where she would find the money to pay for them. When she told her mother that she needed $40 cash money, an expression she had learned from the workers, her mother, perhaps because of her constant state of benign distraction, gave it to her without question. Mimi never told anyone about her sitting with Mr. Sugiyama. She kept the photographs under her clothes in a drawer in her bedroom. She took them out when she was alone and lay on her bed and stared at them. She was not vain. She was not interested in the length of her lashes or the sweet curve of her lower lip. Mimi was trying to understand just who she was and how she came to be that way. So that's one example. Someone the other day asked me if I still have the photographs, and I do. So this is the nonfiction that I'll read to you. The fact, supposedly, I say that very, very ironically, facts. Twice a year, we, my brothers and sisters, were taken downtown to McInerney's store, where clothes would be laid out for our approval by solemn Japanese saleswomen. The McInerneys had been early residents of the islands and had done well, making it all the more thrilling to watch old Miss McInerney boldly stuff girdles, bathing caps, and evening gowns into worn brown paper sacks. Each night, so we were told, Miss McInerney's maid collected all the things that the old lady had stolen that day and returned them to the store, a system that seemed to please everyone, including us. Okay, so now we have the the other facts. So they're at the, they've gone, she's gone to, her name is Cleo, and she's gone with her aunt. There were no other customers in the store that day. Emma and Cleo took the wrought iron cage elevator to the second floor, the children and foundations floor, where they were greeted ceremoniously by Mrs. Okamura. Mrs. Okamura proudly told Cleo that she had helped her mother to order her first trousseau from Vogue magazine. Still looking a little dazed, Mrs. Okamura said that Kitty had not thought the selection at Stance quite right. Mrs. Okamura neatly laid out for their approval all of the things deemed essential for a 13-year-old girl, including, to Cleo's delight, a white cotton brassiere. Emma pronounced brassiere the French way, exaggerating the consonants and giving Cleo a moment's shame. But Cleo's happiness was so complete that she didn't even blush when Emma went on to ask Mrs. Okamura if she advised the wearing of nylon slips, as if nylon were more lascivious, more tending to corruption than cotton. Mrs. Okamura thought that nylon would do very well. Let me just skip down. So no young girl in the world could have been happier than Cleo when Mrs. Okamura ran her competent fingers under Cleo's breast to ensure that the brassiere was a good fit. Mrs. Okamura even called it a training bra, but it was fine with Cleo. There are many packages. Cleo's many packages were to be sent to Wisteria House, but when Emma saw the dismay on Cleo's face when she realized that the pleasure of laying the new clothes on her bed and looking at them would be delayed, she allowed Cleo to pick three things to carry home. Cleo happily lugged the packages after her, banging them awkwardly against her legs as she followed her aunt to the men's department. Emma needed to buy socks for the gardener who'd been complaining of cramp. Cleo waited patiently, thinking of her new things, while Emma chatted with Mr. Day, the sales clerk. As her aunt and Mr. Day discussed the decline of sugar prices, Cleo noticed a woman putting dozens of bow ties into a straw bag. Without looking around, the woman moved confidently to a table laden with men's bathing shorts. She examined and discarded several pairs before she found a few to her liking. She put them into her bag. Cleo was astonished. It was not just the thievery that confused her, but the idea that a woman who seemed so respectable, a woman so like her aunt, was a thief. The woman wore a straw hat with a pheasant feather band and a flower-printed dress and laced white summer shoes chalky with polish. Cleo was so mesmerized that she did not hear Emma call her name. She jumped as if it were she who was filling the straw bag. But Emma did not seem surprised or even concerned. She certainly said nothing to Mr. Day, who, Cleo noticed, allowed his eyes to flicker for only the briefest moment to the woman clumsily wrestling with the torso of a mannequin, the better to remove its terry cloth beach jacket. When they were in the car, Cleo asked Emma if she had seen the woman in the store. "Yes," Emma said, pulling confidently into traffic. The car behind them was forced to change lanes, and the driver made an obscene gesture with his finger. "We were at school together," Emma said. "But did you see what she was doing?" Cleo was suddenly unsure that she had seen anything. So extraordinary did it seem. Emma signaled to turn into the back gate of Wisteria House, her arm held stiffly out the window. "Her name is Alice Stant," she said as she turned, both hands on the big steering wheel. "I'm afraid she has not been herself for some time. Her mother sees that everything is returned the next day, of course. Stant's has always had wonderful delivery service, and I've often wondered if there were any connection." She stopped at the rusted iron gate laced with chicken wire and dead palm branches. She smiled at Cleo as if Miss Stant were only a little eccentric, as if Emma herself were only a little eccentric. She set the heavy handbrake, making her point. Miss Stant was unhappy in love. Cleo nodded in agreement, not understanding but wanting to understand, and jumped out to open the gate. So you see what a writer does with research. And God knows what I will do with the research, with all the information I found here. You saw this lovely, did you see this little small selection of things from the Daisy Bates collection. In my memory, I told this to Mr. Wilkins, I was absolutely convinced that there was a small pair of kid gloves. I mean, I have thought of these gloves for years, and of course, they don't exist.